Good morning. Welcome. This is John Micton, your co-host at the International Schools Podcast. Lovely to have everybody. Dan is traveling and will be with us on the next episode. Over the last few years that we've been doing this podcast, we've had the privilege of having various leaders. We had Vicky Siebert and Liz Free that talked about their leadership capacity and the work that they've done within the schools. And we had Christina DeWitt and Charlotte also from ISKL that talked to us about being IT directors. But the one interesting thing was, and I was just talking to our guests, Kim and Christina, was that they really didn't want to focus on the woman part, but just their capacity as leaders. And I think that's a very powerful message. But today we're going to, we have, first of all, the privilege and honor of having Christina and Kim that have just released a book. And I hopefully, if you have not got it, go and get it. It's called Finding Your Path as a Woman in School Leadership. It is a fantastic book. What's really interesting is both of our guests have extensive experience in the international landscape, international schools and leadership, and many of you are familiar with them. But today what we're going to do is kind of look at some of the themes that they talked about women in leadership and some of the pinch points and opportunities and also the creative tensions. And Dan is going to cringe because I use that word again, but I always do. Anyway, so I just want to give a warm welcome to Kim and Christina. Thank you so much for being on the International Schools Podcast. And more importantly, congratulations on the release of the book.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
So tell us, Kim, what inspired you to be co-authoring a book and why now? I mean, there are a lot of different books on women leadership, maybe not in the international schools sphere, absolutely not. But this has become quite a prominent topic in the corporate world, and you have had a lot of different focuses on that. But why now and why this book for... And correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like it's really targeted to international school leaders, but I think women in leadership in general, but maybe with that sub focus of international schools.
Definitely. So actually, it was really organic. It was not like an intentional or targeted process that we went through. It just so happened that in the fall of 2019, I work with a lot of instructional coaches in programs for my company, Aduro Learning. And I was having a lot of conversations, both with my clients and with guests on my podcast, with women clients who were doing really fantastic things, leadership things in their schools, even without the formal title of leader. And I would say, wow, that's amazing leadership you're showing, or that's a lot of leadership work you've been doing. Or, you know, I'd put the word leadership adjacent to the work they were doing. And all of these women I was talking to were like, no, that's not me. I'm not a leader. No, don't call me that. And I kept having these conversations where these really successful, professional, strong women were really shying away from the title of leader. And I thought, huh, I do the same thing. Like, why is that? Why are so many of us feeling so uncomfortable when we're associated with this word leader? And so I thought, I have this podcast. Why don't I do a little mini series? I'll interview a couple of women heads of school and we'll do like a couple episodes and, you know, see what happens. And I interviewed the first woman. I was like, is there anybody else I should talk to? And that woman gave me another woman. And then I did another interview. And then I did another interview. And then I did another interview. And this was in the spring of 2020. So we all know what was happening at that time. All of these women were really, I think, happy to have a really fulfilling conversation about their professional journey where someone really was genuinely curious about what was it like? Like, how did this happen for you? And it was a nice 1 hour-ish conversation they could have that wasn't about COVID, that wasn't about panic going on in schools. That was a reflective, thoughtful, kind of a coachy conversation, but like just a really nice conversation. And so what happened was I ended up having 70 interviews in the spring of 2020. And after 70-ish, it was over 70, but after 70-ish, I was like, I think I should probably stop this because I could just keep having interviews forever and then like just keep having these interviews. And so I took a pause, had a lot of good conversations with people about those interviews, ended up making a course called Women Who Lead that I offered 3 cohorts of, and then realized that I really wanted to get those stories into more hands than just the people who had the time to take an online course. And Christina was one of the women I interviewed, and I knew that she had just finished her doctorate. And so when I thought, I want to write a book on this, I don't want it to be just the stories. I want it to be really grounded in research. Who can I partner with to make sure this book is grounded in research? And my brain was like, ba-bing, Christina. And so I reached out to Christina. When was that, Christina? Like 2022-ish? We wrote the book in...
Yeah, it was just me. I hadn't finished my doctoral work, but I do remember a conversation. You said, okay, I have a project, but I'm waiting for you to finish your and defend your dissertation, finish your doctoral work, and then I'm going to pitch this project to you. So that was probably like winter 2022. Yeah,
that sounds right. And so we just, I mean, I feel like it fell into my lap, which is not true, obviously, because I just told you about all the work it took to get to that point. But once Christina and I got together to write this book, it was just like such a natural process for us to do this together. Yeah. It just felt so good to be able to come together, not only on the stories that are shared, but on the research that Christina was doing that was giving so much weight to all of the stories that were shared by the women, and then us sharing our own experiences. That's really kind of how it all came to be.
Wonderful. And I just love the whole idea that you started just with these conversations, you know, and where women were saying, no, I'm not a leader. And then you kind of said, oh, I've got something. You built the course, and then you created opportunities. And then that connection, because Christina, you actually are a practitioner. You're chief academic director and principal at George Washington Academy in Casablanca. So you're really on the ground living this. And I love that, you know, through Kim's experience through the interviews and you being one of the interviewees, how you guys suddenly connected. And ironically, as you said, you were doing your doctorate. So of course, doctorates are very research based. Yeah. So, and I think Kim, what really resonates is that you felt apart from those anecdotes and those interviews, you still had that research because that gives it the weight, you know, that gives it the credibility. And we know as educators, you really want, if you're going to push something, it has to be research connected and based. So I think that combination. And Christina, were you one of these people that said, no, don't call me a leader?
It's a really good question. I suspect I might not have been because I had a formal title. And Kim and I, our relationship goes back 10 years. I did a couple of courses with Kim. I've done some private mentoring with her. And so we've really built this relationship over a decade now-ish.
Yes.
And so, it didn't necessarily come out of the blue. I think it's a lot easier when you have that official title as a leader to, you know, it, some days we don't want to embrace it, but the title is there. So yes, I am a leader in my school. My title says that I am, people expect me to be, and that feels a lot different, empowering in a lot of ways, but different than teachers leading in their classrooms, teachers leading students in extracurriculars, teachers taking responsibility or joining a self-study committee, or, you know, leading a workshop after school for their colleagues, right? These are all ways that we know and we see educators leading, but I think we don't always transfer that I'm leading.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's so true. Yeah. And Drew Dudley talks about how we're scared of leadership, you know, that everybody's a leader. And I think I love the way you highlight the idea of extracurricular activities or a club or maybe a grade team, or maybe there's a project and you're year three teacher and suddenly you're saying, you know, I'm really interested in this. I'll organize the meetings and stuff. And I think that word of leadership comes like this dark cloud and responsibility, but there's so many people leading, doing phenomenal stuff at the ground level. In your book, you talk about the challenge often women face to become leaders. But I'm wondering, are there obviously there are very likely many that are quite obvious and we'll go through them, of course. But what are some of the hidden ones that sometimes people don't realize? What are the things that are kind of underground or invisible that actually have a real domino effect on the person's capacity to feel empowered or even feel confident? Christina.
Yeah, that's such a it's so important really to unpack that, right? Because, you know, there are some of those obvious pieces that, like you said, we'll talk about. I think maybe one that comes to mind, one of many, but one that's coming to mind at the top is the idea that women don't often see other women in official leadership capacity titled roles, right? I think we're seeing it more, you know, like we're seeing a lot of other underrepresented groups enter the leadership space. However, if you are not seeing yourself in that role, seeing someone who looks like you or comes from a group that you identify with in those roles, it's a little bit hard to then imagine yourself in that role. So that mentorship, that modeling piece, you know, I would say, yeah, it isn't always fun. And there's that kind of dark cloud of, oh, I'm a leader. There's a big responsibility. But it is, there's a responsibility for those of us who are in those underrepresented groups to step into leadership, to be that person. And that also often feels like a big part of the responsibility when we're there.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned this idea of having mentors or examples or people that you can see acting this out. With the whole bias DEIJ work, that's something that we've had librarians here saying,
yes,
that, you know, it's no good talking about DEIJ if you don't have the books that Absolutely. Actually represent those different marginalized yep. groups. So I think this is really powerful. What you're saying is that if you're in a building and you're the only female leader, well, that doesn't really, but if you have other people, especially for young educators or great team leaders that want to move up in that area, I think what you're highlighting is so important. So
I might also add too that I think there's also one of the hidden problems for women in particular is taking that first step to apply for that first formal leadership role, reading the bullet points in a job posting. You know, oftentimes, anecdotally, there's some research allegedly out there, but it really is not, it's a bit of it's an urban legend or myth of sorts that, you know, women need to feel like they check all of the boxes before they'll apply. Anecdotally, there's vast agreement that, yeah, that's the case. And in fact, I was just having a conversation yesterday with a woman who I work with who's considering a leadership role. And she said, but, you know, I don't have any experience. And I said, you know, it doesn't matter because you're certainly not going to get the job if you don't apply. Yes. So, you know, and the anecdotally, the information bears out that, you know, men will look at that list of, you know, those check boxes and, well, you know, I can do most of this stuff. So of course I'm going to apply and I'll be great at it, because there's this society supports and encourages that, right? We're kind of conditioned that, you know, we have kind of our gender spaces and people can inhabit them in ways that everybody expects. So there is this piece for women, and whether we're perfectionists or, you know, we take seriously the bullet points that are there, that's definitely a bit of a hidden problem, I think, that, you know, women they want to check all the boxes before they will take that first step to even apply for a leadership role. And quite frankly, there's a lot that, as leaders, we're learning on the job and we don't know how to do, and you surround yourself with people who can help you. You have mentors you can go to. And I think being more transparent about that as leaders is really important, so that others can see that, oh, I don't have to know everything, because nobody possibly can.
I think your point's really important. And I know there's no evidence, you know, you were cautioning us about definitive research, but I know in my own experience, mm-hmm. mentoring other people, that this idea of like, well, I don't fill all the boxes, so I can't apply. Well, And I know myself, having applied for many jobs, I'm like, well, I got about 50, 60%. Yeah. I'm good to go, you know? Yeah. And I think there's no harm, as I have told people in my family, there's no harm in apply to 100. All they can say is no, you know? Mm-hmm. And they might actually say yes. So I absolutely agree with you. It would be interesting to have that research, but I think anecdotally, I'm echoing what you have experienced. Kim, you wanted to add to that.
When I was listening to Christina talking about the mentorship and the seeing yourself in the leaders that you work with, another thought came to me from a lot of the stories in the book, which were about the fact that when women move into international schools in particular, and especially women of color, the networks of people that are identify as the same group that are in positions of leadership are much smaller than those who identify with the majority, right? So the majority of current leaders. That piece of like hires like, and a lack of access to networks, it's something that you wouldn't, at least I didn't necessarily think about until it was very clearly explained to me that I just don't know those people and they just don't know me like they know other people who look like them, sound like them, talk like them. So it's like a lack of mentors combined with a lack of the connection between networks that make it so much more difficult to potentially see yourself stepping into that role, or even as Christina was talking about applying for that role, because there's no one else that you know that you could even talk to about it, let alone feel confident enough to do it.
And I think what you're bringing up, we heard from a couple guests, is this idea for people of different ethnic backgrounds really struggling, because it's people of African-Americans that are applying and there are no African-American leaders that they can go and tap into. And how I think that's so important is, where are those people that you feel comfortable and that you can connect with, I think is so important. One of the things that comes up in your book, and I think often I've heard this term, is the idea of imposter syndrome. And this feeling like, oh, I'm not good enough. And maybe Christina, kind of pivoting to some of what you said, this idea of not filling up all the bullets and not being the perfect candidate. Kim, tell us about this imposter syndrome and why, and what brings this about, this idea, especially in the role of women?
I mean, I think Christina kind of nailed it about the not meeting all the requirements and feeling like we have to be, you know, society kind of conditions us to not expect that we can do something unless we can meet all of the requirements on the list. And if there's one bullet point left out, well, I'm going to wait until I can do that one bullet point before I can apply for that position. And even when, going back to the story that I was telling, even when I'm directly exhibiting leadership traits through work that I'm doing and someone calls them out and says, this is leadership, the natural reaction is like, oh no, no, it's not. Like, that's not leadership. So I think that is kind of coming into play. And then there's also a piece in the book, we talk a lot about the power of the nudge and having a mentor and someone tapping you on the shoulder and saying what you're doing is leadership, to recognize the capacity that you're demonstrating and building, and really having the ability to recognize and name the leadership skills that you feel competent in, that can also help overcome this feeling of like, oh no, that's not me. But seeing your skills that you have built as leadership skills is a really empowering feeling.
Do you think sometimes, Kim, then, that the word leadership is being used incorrectly in the different, you know, so we have this image of leadership being, I'm going to say, more of the archaic male dominated hierarchical pyramid. And actually what we know, and if you read a lot of books, I mean, Renee Brown engages with this, Adam Grant, there are many people out there talking about more of a flatline hierarchy, mm-hmm. and this idea of more organic hierarchies. Do you think that in the context that you were working in, most of, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think many of your interviews were with international women educators. Do you think that as international schools, we misunderstand what leadership is, or subliminally we are sending a different message than actually what we claim we are?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of the book. One of the whole chapters of the book is about essential skills for emerging leaders. And when I asked the women, what are these essential skills for emerging leaders? The skills that they talked about were skills that resonate with me as a coach. And I was like, oh, these are not what I would consider like traditional leadership skills. But when they're put into that context, I'm like, oh, those are leadership skills. And so many things about relational leadership, building relationship, building trust, building collective efficacy, this kind of, we're working together towards a common goal, building a shared vision, all of these things that don't have to be that stereotypical vision of what leadership is. And so I think that is where a lot of these feelings come from and a lot of this perception comes from, that leadership looks like this one way that society has told for a very long time that this is what leadership looks like. And we need to reframe that a little bit. And many of the women, I'm thinking specifically of Fiona Reynolds, talked about the way that we can reframe that for ourselves. And it's also making me think of a story. Christina's story is making me think of Madeline Hyde, I think, who was the one who talked about that she saw an application or a job posting for a principal position. And she was like, oh my gosh, I can do these things. And she brought it home to her husband and she was like, I can do these things. And he's like, yeah, of course you can. Go apply for that. She's like, me? And he's like, yes. You know, but like all of this reinforcement you need because we have this stereotypical vision of what leadership is. Oh, I'll tell one more story. Another great story in the book is from Melanie Verba, who at the time was at Canadian Academy in Kobe, Japan. And the high school principal had to take emergency medical leave. So she stepped in and she said to her daughter, who was maybe like 7 or 10 or something at the time, I'm going to be the acting principal. And her daughter said, Mom, you can't be the principal. Principals are men. And she was like, okay, this is my path forward now, right? So The issue that this book is bringing to the forefront, I hope that part of that this book is bringing to the forefront is like, this is not just for our current generation of leaders. It's not even for the next generation of leaders. It's for the children that we're working with in our school every single day to see that anyone can be a leader. It's not just this one definition.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring up the anecdote of the young girl reacting to her mother. I work in a primary school where there are only 4 men. And a lot of kids are surprised, like, why are you a teacher? You're a guy, you know? And I've had those conversations. So it's interesting how, you know, in schools, we've created these expectations and these hierarchies and that, why would you become a principal if you're a woman? It's just unbelievable. And your point is so really resonates with me. The idea is we have to remember we have a generation of young girls coming up the ranks. Right. And, you know, we can say, okay, we can't do anything about it. No, because we want them to have a frame of reference where they know anything is possible. I could be, you know, the president or whatever it might be. And I think that is so important that you bring that up, is what are we curating and choreographing as schools and educators and organizations to make sure that whole community of young ladies and girls can come up and say, ah, I've got these points of reference. Of course, it's normal. Christina, you wanted to add on Kim's share.
Yeah, I was just going to add, like, in a very minimal amount of research that I've tapped into has referenced this a concept of androgynous leadership and this idea that, you know, anybody, you know, these are the leadership skills like Kim was referring to. This is what good leaders do. This is what they need to develop. These are the competencies. And it applies to, you know, whether you're, you know, white cis male or, you know, Black LGBTQ identified individual, right? It doesn't matter. This is good leadership. And we need to, you know, I think that's the work that we're doing here, is we're trying to break down that while our focus is women, it doesn't matter. Like, as we're opening doors for the minority, the non-majority, we're opening doors for everyone.
Yeah.
Right? So
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that you brought this idea of not gender identifying with leadership, men leaders, mm-hmm. women leaders. It seems that when you put that word, the focus becomes on that word and no more the leadership, you know? Somehow having that word, suddenly everybody says, oh, women leaders, you know, it's a whole different dynamic. They're different. Women leaders do differently. But you're saying, no, it's about good leadership. Leadership is not tied to women or men. It's just the fact that they're good, you know, they're good ways to be a leader. So that really makes absolute sense. Christina, you have talked, and Kim has talked, to this idea of mentorship, you know, being able to reach out. And you talked about the nudge and also the work that you've done in your interviews and also working with people. Talk a bit about this idea of mentorship and what might young women leaders or current educators that are thinking of going into leadership, why is that mentorship so important and what might it look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, at the risk of repeating, right, it is that idea that it's seeing someone like yourself doing this work and being able to then envision that, oh, that could be me. I think, you know, the Melanie Verbus story and her daughter, I have a 23-year-old daughter, and I know that she views the possibilities for her and her opportunities, as a young professional. You know, she's already now looking at ways in which she can develop. You know, how is she finding, she's laying her path, right? And she's able to recognize, you know, a recent opportunity that was offered to her in her current job, that this is a small step on that path to get her to who even knows where, right? But it's that opportunity. So I think, you know, it's maybe it isn't an oversimplification. It really is that, someone who is looking to become a leader. And I have to say too, I listen for that in my current role. And this past week, there have been at least three different opportunities where, you know, younger women my age, women who identify as white, women who identify as non-white, you can hear, you know, you see them perk up like, oh, that's an interesting opportunity. Might that meet? So it's yes, you, and here's, yes, apply for that job. Yes, watch for this job posting. Yes, this is a great first step for you to consider taking if you think that this is the trajectory you want to go on. Yes, we can provide support and mentoring to help you grow. And I think that's another piece that's just really important. And I'll try not to go off on this tangent, but it's how can we, in our international schools, in our organizations, set up systems to grow people to become what they would like to be, to have safe opportunities to explore, you know, that maybe mini, you know, leading a PLC, taking on taking a couple of hours from their teaching responsibilities to, you know, maybe be like that dean of students to help the vice principal with discipline or whatever it might be. So I think it's a responsibility that we take on as individuals, but I think there are so many opportunities for the system to build those in as well.
I think, Christina, your point about if with any change, you can have those conversations, you can highlight them, but if it's not systematic, if it's not structured inside the organization, that change can be very haphazard and it can depend on a personality or a person that's there at the time. But I think exactly is, you know, what are schools doing to amplify the opportunities for leadership? But it doesn't mean that everybody's going to become the school director, but it means they're just, I love your idea of the PLC or maybe doing a couple hours helping a group of, say, a certain grade group that's struggling with something, and you could be the lead on that. I think that's so important. And somehow we're very reticent to do that. I think I think it has to do with control and power is, you know, well, I don't want too many people making decisions, or I don't want people eating away at my power structure. And I think that has to do also with the comfort of what leadership should look like. One thing that I've been on the circuit for far too long, and the old boys network. Now, I know we're going to ruffle feathers, and I'm okay. I have gray hair. I'm part of the old boys network in the sense that I'm a male that's been on the circuit for a very long time. And I know that, you know, as I was going up in my own professional journey, there are certain cliques of school directors and you know, the organizations that are very, very targeted towards a certain social dynamic, right? Demographic. And this old boys network, I think a lot of it might not be actually choreographed on purpose. It might just be by default, or also the way societies work, or in an international setting, sometimes things take much longer. I think sometimes progress and this whole gender equity thing, maybe in the international school circuit, we're much more insular. It's much easier to kind of push things out and not let them trickle in. But Kim, I want you to talk about this old boys network and how this can really impact that process of exploring professional journeys. And what can schools and what can people do to kind of shift that feeling? And it might be a perception that's not actually out there. I'm making some generalizations here, but I sense that if it was up in the book, it's something that really resonated and came out.
Yes, I think it's definitely there. There's some really good quotes in the book about the old boys club too. So definitely explore that chapter. But I think the biggest takeaway that I have from all of these interviews is that it's the responsibility of the people in those positions of power to ensure that they are not continuing this like hires like endless cycle of the same type of person for those same positions. It can't be the people who are at the disadvantage changing the system because they have very little power in the system, if any. So the system itself, those that are already in power are the ones that have to make the change. So if, for example, you're a head of school or in a senior leadership position and you go to a recruiting fair and you're at the cocktail hour and you look around and all you see are people who look just like you, with the exception of three or four non-white males in the age range of 45 to 55 or whatever it is, that's a moment of self-reflection that needs to happen because that is not an equitable distribution of leadership positions in particularly international schools, but I think in lots of places, but especially in international schools. So I think that opportunity for people who are in positions of power to spend a tiny bit of money to buy this book and see what it's like for people who don't look, sound like you, what that experience is like for them. So that can help you recognize the ways that you can actively and intentionally work towards making a more equitable institution for your own school and for the school community. That's the number one thing that has to happen.
And I think what you're saying is so important because that then also we were talking about the young girl telling her mother she couldn't be a principal. There is a domino effect. It's very invisible, but there is this very powerful domino effect. And I think, you know, we've heard a lot about that is if you're in a position in power comes immense responsibility, but not the responsibility to, you know, to be the leader and make the decisions, but the responsibility to make sure things are equitable, that you understand how you got there and what that means and what luxuries you have because of it. But within that position, you can actually shift and change things. You can stand up at the cocktail hour and tell the person that's organizing, you know, this is the third year I'm here. I only see a certain type of person here. What are we going to do? What are you going to do as an organization? What can I do to help you change that? I think it's being more aggressive is the wrong word, but more proactive in really saying, I'm noticing this. And it's about self-reflection. You talk about that really is, what am I doing to self-reflect, to actually notice what's around me? And what can I do because I am in this room that I could change things? And I can't agree more than you as pick up that book and read it. I think, you know, those are the things that are really going to help us in our own self-reflections. Christina, you had some add-ons.
I did. You know, I would just like to, again, building on what Kim is saying, your response, it's that idea of, you know, what are some of those really simple They are very simple actions, but they're very self-reflective. You are in the sea of men. For example, at a recruiting fair cocktail hour, and you notice people who are not men, go engage in a conversation with them, make them feel welcome, because that is so awkward. Just anecdotally, I was recently at a recruiting fair as a recruiter. I will say in a couple of the sessions they had, the diversity is looking better than it used to. You know, but I entered the hotel gym space with 8 or 9 other leaders who were all men. I was the only woman, right? So there are still spaces. You know, what are you doing to network as leaders in schools? Are you going golfing? The golf course isn't necessarily where you always find women. Are you going to happy hour? Any age Muslim educator who is a leader is probably not going to join you at happy hour. A mom is probably not going to join you at happy hour because of family responsibilities. You know, in all fairness, a young father might not be joining because of sharing responsibilities at home. So how do we, you know, what spaces does that informal networking take place that excludes particular lots of groups, actually? So, you know, those are some really reflective opportunities for leaders, but organizations as well, I think.
I think there are a lot of people who would be happy not to have to go to the cocktail hour after a day sitting interviewing people, and would prefer a morning breakfast with some really good coffee and some croissant. But I agree, Christina. Thank you for bringing that up, because it's not only the event, but it's everything around it. You know, let's think. I love the idea that you're saying, you know, that there are Muslim colleagues. They don't want to go and sit around alcohol, or the young mother that's, you know, doing a FaceTime call with her kids late at night because the time zone such, or even a young father. So I think really us saying, let's throw this all out and let's start from scratch and think, who is really the audience that we want? Not the audience that we have, but what do we want? What do we want to change? And I love that you brought those things up. Thank you. That's really so important. One of the things that you kind of tap into, and I would like to learn more from both of you, is this idea: international schools are very multicultural. And now you're seeing more and more schools, for-profit and non-profit, but they're being opened up by non-Western organizations. The leaders are not Western or Anglophone. You have a far more multicultural landscape in the international school world. And you touched on to the idea that, you know, if you're from certain minorities, often the challenge is even greater. But talk to us a bit about what have you seen, and what are the different cultural language expectations that affect women who are in these diverse cultures? And is that another added challenge on top of being a woman? I'll let either of you jump in.
Yeah, 100%. There are, you know, the intersectionality of, and I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East in my international experience. So, you know, I know that there are, you know, I'll speak to, you know, covered Muslim women who are powerhouses, amazing educators with amazing leadership potential, but there are recruiters and schools who will never look at them and consider them because of that. You know, a lot of recruiting platforms have gone to, you know, no pictures, right? But eventually someone is going to emerge on a screen or face-to-face to interview. And, you know, that reality is, you know, it creates an obstacle for those women. There's also the desire, and, you know, I've seen it in all of the schools I've worked in, where, you know, the speaking, being a native speaker of English or bilingual in a to the extent that you do not possess an accent, I'll use air quotes around that, when you speak English, you know, that is also desired, right? Like, just So if, for example, you are a woman who wears the hijab and English is not your native language, you have an intersectionality of who defining who you are as a leader. And, you know, that is going to create a challenge. I'll kind of turn this over to Kim because she knows a lot of the stories of the women leaders that she interviewed far more than I do. But there's also the many of us are kind of short and we're petite. And, you know, that visual is always a little bit, whether people are aware of that or not, that's also a challenge for some of us.
Kim.
Yes. So, Christina, everything you said totally resonates from the stories in the book and all the interviews that I had. But just thinking about the layers of potential additional challenges as you add on intersectionalities. So the idea that, like, first there's the stereotypical kind of definition of leader as being male. So then you've got women as the first, like, barrier. And I don't even want to use the word barrier because that's not right. But the first kind of layer, then you add anything else on top of that. You're Black, you're LGBTQI, you're covered, you're Asian, whatever the things are, there's additional stereotypes that go along with that. And so now you're layering one on top of another. And for me, that was one of the most eye-opening part of these interviews is hearing those conversations back to back to back to back to back about the layers of intersectionality and how each additional layer presents another hurdle to overcome. And Christina, even the thing about being small, you know, maybe you're a woman, you're small, you're Asian, you come from an early elementary background, and then all of a sudden, well, how could you possibly be a head of school? You're just a primary teacher, you know, and it's just all wrapped up in one package. And it takes a little bit to unpack all of those pieces. So I think getting an awareness or having an awareness and understanding of those layers that come with all of those identities that we can hold, that's really important. And it's very hard, no matter how open you try to be to these things, it's very hard to see that unless you're making an intentional effort. And so thinking a little bit about what we were also talking about recruiting, these interviews, I was intentionally seeking out women with many different stories, many different identities, because I didn't want to hear just one woman's story told by 30 different people. I wanted to hear as many different stories as possible. And so our work in international schools, the same should apply in recruiting. The same should apply in these conversations that were happening. It's not just who shows up. Who are you seeking out? Who are you making the effort to find? And I think that is where a lot of times we can settle into complacency. Oh, that person didn't show up. I didn't see that application, or that resume didn't cross my path, or that person didn't apply, or whatever it might be. There's also the extra effort to go out and find those people. And so I think understanding the stories may help those who are in positions to make those changes recognize how important it is to be intentional about this work.
So I have a question. I'm a parent that knows nothing about international schools, and I'm surfing the web and I'm reading these mission statements and these learning and these values about equity, gender equality, that we care for the world, we want to change the world for a better place. And these missions are not new. We've had these for, I've been around long enough to know that kind of narrative has been part of the mission. How can we have these missions and then have this situation here? I would love to hear from you.
I know Christina will have stuff to say about this too, but I will just point out the one in particular survey, the Diversity Collaborative Survey, very specifically the research came out of that saying that we are excellent at identifying this in our missions and trying to build this for our students, but we don't do a very good job about applying that to the actual staff and in particular the leadership staff at the school. In that same survey, they also say that when schools are intentional about this process, they can make a change. So it is within the capacity of the individual school to make a change. But on the whole, we're really good at looking at our school population and saying, this is what we want our school population to be once they leave our institution. But the hierarchical structures of power are quite safe where they are, right? And so this would require them to change. And we all know how hard that is. And so yes. I think ultimately it's like, that's great for them, but not so great for me.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Christina?
Yeah, it's also true, right? And I think it's that, you know, it's we can have policy statements, we can have missions, visions, values, but we have to also embrace them and live them. And a lot of times, as we know, like when we're trying to make a change in our personal life, you have to be very intentional about that. You have to check in on that every day. What did we do today? What are we going to do today? It's really interesting because this was a common question at the recent recruiting fair I was asked. It's almost like the candidates are reading from a script of questions. You know, what is your policy around DEIJ? And quite frankly, I'm at a school right now, we don't have one. We have a lot of other issues that we need to tackle, to be fair. But at the same time, I look at my school and the diversity among the staff. We have a significant population of our staff who are women of color from the States, from African, you know, from African countries. We have a significant population on our staff who are local Moroccans, who are speakers of Darija and French and English. And, you know, part of me is, and, you know, I probably have to be careful how I say this, but like, we don't have a policy, but we're living this. So what is more important in a school? I think it depends. I think a policy is really helpful. A value statement can help, you know, center and amplify that we value this. But at the same time, I look at into my staff and I'm like, we have an unwritten statement. This is what we value. And so I think there's something kind of between that value statement and policy and what you're living, and just kind of finding that path of living it, right? Whether you have that statement or not.
And I think that's interesting, you bringing that up as your anecdote, is this you know, setup that you have where you have this diversity, but actually you don't have anything written. So if I'm a new leader coming to your school and I go out recruiting, there's no explicit agenda saying you need to think about a diverse pool of candidates that you work with. Maybe it's about having both, you know, the intentionality and doing it, and, you know, the invisible that happens. But having that policy, because very likely there are schools around the world that are not in your situation, and having a policy, even maybe a overarching organization like ECIS, IRCOS, or CIS, some of the accreditation organizations, making it explicit as part of your journey to be accredited, what are the evidences of policies and actions that you're doing to amplify these opportunities for marginalized groups to be in leadership? And we're specifically talking about women. So yeah, no, it's interesting because I think so often you do see diversity. And I definitely, in some of the opportunities I have to work with school, I'm seeing that much more than 10 years ago, which is great. It's fantastic. One of the things that, you know, if you're on LinkedIn or you read the New York Times bestsellers list, there's a lot of books, and I'm not trying to say it's great, but a lot of books about women in leadership in the corporate world. And you have various, you know, people that in Silicon Valley that are amplifying that they're a woman, they're running, you know, multi-billion dollar companies. And there's a lot of talk about that. Do you think the journey of women leaders in international schools is different than what maybe people are experiencing in the corporate world or outside of international schools? Maybe let's say education, because I know universities also have some of different dynamics, and depending in the countries you are, there are actually laws and various other things. But from both of your experience, do you think that experience that a woman leader in an international school setting might have different experiences and might need different sets of understandings compared to if they read a book about a corporate woman leader?
I can start, and Christine, I know we'll pick up. So I think yes is the short answer to that question, but it was interesting because I was just on another podcast where I was interviewed by someone who comes from the corporate world. And she was like, I'm so curious, like, tell me about what it's like in schools. Like, how does this work? And I'm telling her all these stories about how very often women in schools, when they're finding their way to leadership, they don't go on a very straight path. They kind of go on a meandering path to leadership. Like maybe they'll start out and be a grade level leader, and then they'll be an instructional coach, and then they'll maybe be a curriculum leader, and then maybe they'll come over here, and then eventually they'll end up somewhere in senior leadership. Whereas for most men, it's a much straighter path. I'm a teacher, I'm a head of department, I'm an assistant principal, suddenly I'm a senior leader, right? And she was like, really? Because it's not like that in the corporate world. And I'm like, yeah, like everything about internet schools, maybe specifically international schools, which is where most of the women, you've mentioned that a couple of times, John. Yes, most of the women I interviewed are in international schools. So it is a very, leans very heavily into the international school world. Most of the experiences that we have, it's a little bit different than corporate. And on top of that, we know that in schools, there's very few middle leader positions, right? There's not a lot of opportunity to kind of step into leadership, be mentored along the way, you know, follow someone through that pathway. It's kind of a big leap. And so that is also different from the corporate world. And I think we all know there's very few books and especially very little research specifically on international schools. So I think that is another kind of unique area here. It's not just about education, but it really is highlighting international schools. Yeah, I think that's what I wanted to say about that.
So interesting to hear that. And I love the anecdote where you have this person from the corporate world that's listening to this meandering line that people are doing. And they're like, what is this? That's fascinating.
She was also quite horrified about the daughter's, because there's a very big difference if you're in the corporate world versus when you're in schools. In the corporate world, you don't have young people looking at you as a role model as part of your job. You're working with only adults. In schools, we're also working with children. So there's an additional layer of pressure there. And that also in some ways can make schools operate a little more traditionally than maybe business would, because parents are watching what's happening in this institution. And if parents in the host country or parents of students at this school don't think that women should be in leadership positions for whatever reason, there's pressure then from the family side that you would never see in the corporate world, because maybe not never, but you would rarely see in the corporate world, because parents aren't paying attention to what's going on there because their children aren't in the workplace. So we've got so many layers of pressure and so many opportunities for traditional, stereotypical, hierarchical structures to be continually reinforced over and over again in a multi-generational way, that it really just does make it harder for things to change. Doesn't mean it can't change. It just may be a little bit slower.
And it's really interesting that you bring up this idea of the parent stakeholder group, and depending what culture they're in, you know, depending what the role of women are in their own societal context,
absolutely,
can really have an impact on what their daughter might be able to do or what they perceive. Or they might be very uncomfortable sitting in a room with a woman leader and would prefer to have a man or whatever
and
it might be. So
who's on the board? Who's doing the hiring for that head of school position?
Yeah.
And then that trickles down to every other leadership position in the school. So these are things we don't think about when we think about the structures of our schools, but they impact every layer.
Yeah, fascinating. And that impact and domino effect is really, that's where I think, you know, as you both were saying, that self-reflective piece, you know, what are you doing in that position to self-respect? You know, put on those glasses like somebody new in the room and like, oh, everybody's the same color. Everybody's the same age. You know, I think that's the journey that we all have to do as leaders, is have the bravery and courage to do that. Christina, you wanted to add to what Kim had to say.
Yeah, I think Kim is sharing kind of a conversation that she's had recently, which I find so interesting. And, you know, I think I would add on, you know, international schools, you know, the original international schools and maybe the incoming ones, like, you know, what is their purpose? Like, why were they established, right? There's kind of this colonialism piece and the you know, the value being placed on that white man, English speaking leader, that is going to, you know, somehow lift up and elevate all of the children in that school to be able to go to universities in, you know, English speaking places. So I'll leave it at that. So, I mean, there, I mean, the system is based, that's what our system is kind of based on. And what we're trying to, I think a lot of us now, especially in the last 5 to 7 years, are kind of getting on board and recognizing we need to break this system because this isn't really good for anyone.
Absolutely not.
I will also add that, you know, thinking of three particular women, a couple who are very close friends, one in project management, another one who's a high senior executive in health insurance, and then my daughter who works in a kind of a training field, kind of education adjacent. They really actually, in talking about the book with them and the research and different things, they do see parallels in, you know, imposter syndrome, the networking that does happen, the systems in the organizations where they've had experience. So I think there are some connections to be made, and the research does show parallels in some ways, but I think, you know, to Kim's point, like that path of getting to leadership, I feel is less direct in school. So I just kind of wanted to add that on.
Absolutely. But I think your point about the colonialism and the kind of the white leader is ingrained. You know, many schools, when they started in the 60s or even before, I'm in a school that started in 1924. You look at the pictures, they're female teachers, but none of the leaders are women, you know. And so, but that's just the age of the time and society, and, you know, it's a reflection. But I think you saying that this needs to be broken, because we know that the greater diversity you have in a room, the richer the perspectives, the richer the opportunities, and you're going to come up with something much better than if you just have one single voice or a certain profile of person in the room. So I absolutely agree with what you're both saying. We're kind of coming to the end, and what I would love is if you would be comfortable sharing one thing that you want a female educator to think of and something you would like to ask of school leaders.
So I think I'll start with the school leaders, right? I think the book is really important because we have...
I'm going to read it out again because when you bring it close to the screen, it goes, Finding Your Path as a Woman in School Leadership. You can get that at any online bookstore, yeah. Finding Your Path as a Woman in School Leadership. Sorry, Christina, to cut you off there.
No, thank you. I appreciate that, John. We specifically set out, you know, to share the stories of women leaders, to, you know, create a foundation of research, but also each chapter ends with actions, that it's the take action section, right? Whether you're an emerging, aspiring leader, you know, how can you start intentionally developing your path, taking those steps? If you are an established leader, how can you look around you and find opportunities to mentor and support? And really, because of some of the amazing feedback that we had from the early reviewers, we added a third section that is for organizations specifically, a group of senior leaders, a PLC, a book study within a school, to really focus on that self-reflection. We have provided some really good opportunities, if I may say so, for individuals and organizations to reflect, to do some auditing, to develop ways in which they can improve the system for the non-majority, whether it's a woman, whether it's a person of color, someone who is, you know, identifies as LGBTQ. So I'll leave it at that.
But I apologize because I should have emphasized that throughout the book. What I like is the action part. So it's actually, you know, it's a book, but it's a workbook. It's a talking point. It's a journey that actually schools could go through is reading together. Because exactly as you said, Christina, you have the actions and then you also have this, oh, you might want to just get a group of people in the morning over a coffee. Let's use this talking point, you know, just imposter syndrome, for example. So I think, as you know, for our audience to understand, you can read the book as you would read any book and then in isolation. But actually, if you do it as a community of learners, there are a lot of segues and opportunities in there for really you to build on that. So thank you for breaking that down so clearly, Christina. I appreciate that. Kim.
Christina nailed it. I echo everything she said. Thank you. That was beautiful. And I just think the word that summarizes, I think, our conversation and a big piece of the book is that concept of self-reflection for the individual to recognize the ways that you actually are building and demonstrating leadership skills, that you are creating that capacity in yourself for yourself. You have the potential to take whatever that next step is, and self-reflection for our leaders to see how are we making this workplace more equitable for everyone, whether that's intentionally tapping people on the shoulder or that's changing systems and structures that make our workplace more equitable. It's just that piece of self-reflection. And John, as you just said, I do think the book really guides you through that process, whether it's an individual level or a team level or a whole school-wide level.
Hopefully a whole school-wide level, right?
Yes.
That's what we want. I just want to remind our audience, Kim and Christina have been wonderful with the show notes. I know many of you always refer to our show notes, so go to the show notes. There's all kinds of very helpful resources, and I definitely encourage you to follow Kim, who does Adora Learning. She's the creator of the Coach Women Who Lead, Cotel, and author of Coach Better, host and podcast, and Christina, of course, as chief academic director, principal, and author at George Washington Academy. But do spend time going to see their resources. And if you're not following them, get on your social media, follow them, and hopefully you can engage in those conversations that are so important. Christina and Kim, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I know how busy you are, and very likely everybody under the sun wants to talk to you because this book is really so important. And I just appreciate and have and feel privileged to have had the time with both of you on this podcast. And thank you so much, and look forward to hearing as you progress and that hopefully schools understand this rich opportunity to pick up the book and use it as a professional learning journey. Thank you both.
Thank you, John.